The Little Way, A Spirituality of Imperfection. This talk was given by Father Richard Rohr in Bend, Oregon in February of 2007. Father Rohr, a Franciscan, spends much of his time giving talks and retreats in the United States and around the world. He is the founder of the Center for Action and Contemplation in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and is a frequent speaker and writer on issues of community building, peace, and justice.
They've been kind enough to give me three different opportunities, and in a certain way, a small introduction to each of these themes. But the one, as you saw today, is called Breathing Underwater, the Spirituality of the 12 Steps. That has become our sort of code phrase for 12-step spirituality, coming from a poem that I quoted on my very first set of CDs, 12, 15 years ago, I guess, called Breathing Underwater. And it became a metaphor for what the addict has to learn to do. And then we made a second set unpackaging the theme. And what I'd hoped to do in this really just little over an hour is give you some summary understanding of what we're saying there. I asked Richard to place this icon in front of me that probably is a surprise to many of you. It's the icon of Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, the young French Carmelite nun who died at the beginning of the last century. I am convinced, returned to the mainline Christian tradition at least, what I will call the spirituality of imperfection. It's always been, and if we had longer, we would try to chart the course. It's been a subtext. It's been a minority position. And I was so glad I heard your remarks this morning, Richard, because I can see that the Celtic tradition was a significant piece of that spirituality of imperfection. And again, you made such a good point that I think once Christianity wedded with empire under Constantine after 313, the true gospel, by and large, is always a subtext. Religious life is born in the 4th century as they all go off to the deserts of Syria and Egypt and say what's happening in Rome has little to do with anything Jesus talked about. And I think most of us from the mainline churches were never told that. We didn't realize what a compromise took place. And of course, once you align with empire, what your spirituality becomes in one form or another is a spirituality of perfection, achievement, accomplishment, performance, attainment, willpower. And I want to focus in right on that. Because what a spirituality of imperfection is saying, and what the 12-step program brought to light again in the last century, was that great word that is still resisted by many comfortable people, let's just put it that way, is the word powerlessness. And what I'd like to begin with is a parable from Luke 18 that really was one of Thérèse's favorite parables. It might just seem as a, you know, lesser important one, but as you know, Jesus taught, at least Matthew's gospel says, and Luke's, that he taught primarily through parables, which is tying up again with so many key things you said this morning. I don't think parables lend themselves to dualistic thinking. They are very similar in many ways to Confucian riddles and Zen koans, which seek to undo the rational linear mind because they can't be put into simple either-or thinking. But in this particular one, he does teach in a way that will sound dualistic, but I will call it rather, it's a dialectic, playing between the two. So here it is. Now, as you know, Jesus, a consummate Jew, uses the examples from his own culture, his own time, and those people who in Christian language have become bad people, Pharisees. Really, if you know the history, they were really the very good people who were trying to obey the law, who were trying to do it right. These would be your good, you know, daily communicant Catholics. These would be your Bible-reading Protestants, the ones who did it right. And he sets up a contrast, so you have to struggle with this spirituality that I'm calling spirituality of perfection, spirituality of imperfection. And again, as I say, it was one of her favorites. Notice the lead-in line. This is Luke 18:9. Then he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and therefore despised others. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. Now, you know, according to normal definition, the Pharisees are the good guys, the tax collectors are the bad guys who have totally aligned with the Roman Empire and are charging money, giving it to the empire away from their own Jewish people. So no one likes the tax collectors, and everybody looks up to the Pharisees. And as always, Jesus, in his non-dual way of thinking, turns it all on its head. The Pharisee stood, and he prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other people. Extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even this poor tax collector over here who, you know, works together with the Roman Empire. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. Now, you know, none of us would be so foolish as to state our spiritual credits that forthrightly, but we do feel them inside. You know what I mean? You know you do. I'm a good person. I don't steal. I don't lie. I don't cheat. We've all fashioned our positive, superior self-image of why we're so right and why we're so good. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, Jesus said, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. Now, you've got to see this repositions the whole role of religion. I mean, didn't most of you think, I certainly did, that it's all a meritocracy? That's my word. It's all a merit badge system. It's all achievement, accomplishment, performance, and perfection. And the good people win. It's a win-lose scenario. And once, of course, you create anything, a win-lose scenario, the irony is everybody loses. I think of that when I see, I must admit I've turned it on several times, American Idol. And you see the starting with all these thousands of young, idealistic, hopeful kids coming, you know, and they whittle it down to one. And everybody loses. And then the poor one, who supposedly won, has got to spend the rest of his life or her life promoting herself to prove that she is the greatest, she is the best. Why can't people see that the competitive game is not the way to go? And I'm convinced what Jesus gave us was saying that his good news, that we eventually called gospel, was that God's work, and he learned this from the Jewish tradition, from God's choice always of the excluded one, the rejected son, David, the barren women, whatever. It's always the choosing of the enslaved people in Egypt. And the Jews got it. Of course, it became a minority position there too, I'm sure. This recognizing that it's not a winner script, but it's a loser script. Now, if you're insulted by that, it probably means you're still in the false self, all right? It's a loser script where, ironically, everybody wins. Now, you just fast forward from that Jewish tradition, from Jesus' attempt to coalesce it and put it together, to the Celtic tradition, to, I'd like to say, my own Franciscan tradition. Francis clearly understood a spirituality of imperfection. He said he wanted to wear patches on the outside of his habit so everybody know what he was like on the inside. He didn't want us to be priests because he knew once we became ordained, we would have to speak the party line. But no sooner had we buried him, this happens to every tradition, we become drawn into the desire to look good and to be a part of the system that is. And pretty soon they were ordaining us, and we were pretty much like every other kind of priest, except we wore brown robes and sandals, you know. And we weren't that alternative position on the side, up to Thérèse of Lisieux. I want to point out Thérèse, who died at the age of 24, her autobiography, Story of a Soul, has been translated into all the major languages of the world. She's a simple French girl, but she is the only woman ever proclaimed a doctor of the church, or any person proclaimed a doctor of the church, which when you're proclaimed a doctor of the church, it says your teaching is thoroughly reliable. You can trust the teaching of this person. She's the only uneducated doctor of the church. No formal education, not even high school. And her teaching is declared. I don't think Rome knew when it did what it was doing. Because she looked so sweet and, you know, a French nun, Carmelite, what could she be saying that wasn't orthodox? But once you get inside of it, you realize it's not the mainline text at all. She called it, this was her own phraseology for her teaching, the little way, the little way. And she said, that what the church had by and large taught was the big way. Now, I'm calling the big way the way of perfection and achievement, of power, spiritual power that I've got. The subtext that we learn from the Jews is the little way. That is the excluded one, the enslaved one, the barren one, the rejected one that God chooses. Deuteronomy makes that very clear. God did not choose you because you were the greatest of all the nations. God chose you because you were the least of all peoples. There it is, right at the beginning. But the book that I'm almost finished with is going to be called Connecting the Dots, the Prime Ideas of Scripture. And my whole desire, at least, in this book is to show how there's the capsulized comment, the capsulized insight already clearly in the Torah, in Genesis and Exodus and Deuteronomy, those three especially, not the other two so much. But then you'll see how it keeps trying to break through, keeps trying to be understood. But if you can connect the dots, you can see the continuity is there. And the secret in interpreting the Scriptures, I'm convinced, is to learn how to connect the dots and see where the text is going, see where the tangent is going. That's what fundamentalism will not do. It picks out chosen texts which tend to validate your own cultural assumptions and your own temperamental preferences. And you, as you well know, you can prove anything you want from one line of the Bible, Hebrew Scriptures or Christian Scriptures. And that's exactly what is happening. And until we learn how to connect the dots, see the capsulized comment, see the character development, and for those of us who are Christians, seeing how Jesus sums up that character development and simply personifies the best that is Judaism. And I consider Judaism archetypal religion. It does it absolutely right and does it absolutely wrong. Gets the point and absolutely misses the point. And both are revealed in the text. And you want to know something? Catholicism perfectly imitated Judaism. Does it beautifully right and terribly wrong at the same time. And you want to know something? Protestantism perfectly imitated Catholicism and did it perfectly right. Just got it in these capsulized moments of insight. Like Luther's insight of grace and law. And then I meet Lutherans today who are just as legalistic as the most legalistic Catholics and legalistic Jews I've ever met. Because if you don't advance in your own inner journey, which is what you're doing here, you will not come to what looks like a subtext, but is really the text, which is the spirituality of imperfection, powerlessness. And now, in its newfound language and home, we are calling 12-step spirituality, which says the first step, the starting place, is the admission of powerlessness. And what we have here in the tax collector is one who admits powerlessness. You see? That's why Jesus says, this guy goes home justified. Whereas the Pharisee, who by all criteria has followed the rules and done it right, is too filled with himself to have any room inside of himself for God. So I'm going to say that imperfection is the organizing principle of the entire human and spiritual enterprise. Imperfection is not just in the great spiritual traditions to be tolerated, excused, marginalized, or contextualized, or even forgiven. It is the framework, listen closely, it is the very framework inside of which God makes the God self known and calls us into union. You see, you can't talk about union when you're talking about two perfections. It's like trying to put two balloons together. They're both so whole and inflated and entire, they don't need one another. The entranceway is what the alcoholics rightly call the hole in the soul. The wound, the tragic flaw that both Greek theater and Shakespearean drama made as their center point. Now, we created a word for it from Augustine, which wasn't real fortunate. We call it original sin. I know the word isn't liked by most people, because for most people, sin implies culpability, implies fault or impurity or something I have done wrong. And that's not the meaning of original sin. In fact, exactly the opposite. It's trying to name, with an unfortunate use of words, a fly in the ointment, a crack in the vessel. And once you're told about that tragic flaw, like Greek and Shakespearean drama does, puts it right on center stage, literally, then you're not surprised by it. You're not shocked by it. You don't use religion to cover it up and pretend that it's not true. You, and you used the word again this morning, Rich, you weep over it. Now, I always tell the men at the initiation rites that the weeping mode, it's the powerless first step, by the way, is different than the controlling mode. It's different than the fixing mode. It's different than the understanding mode. That's why it was called faith. I can't get my logic around it. It doesn't work. It's not a 2 + 2 = 4 universe anymore. That pulls you into what the Buddhists would certainly call the great compassion. Where now I'm meeting more and more people. Met a wonderful recent widow recently who had a wonderful married life with her husband, and I knew them both. And she used this phrase that I am hearing more and more with great kindness in her voice. She said, "It is what it is." It is what it is another statement for that first step, for learning how to breathe underwater, inside of the pain, inside of the mystery. It is what it is. Now, you see, when you're raised in a spirituality of performance or perfection, you will find it very hard to say that, even on your deathbed. And I've been at the deathbeds of rich Catholics who've never accepted it is what it is. And then I always say, have to do all their homework in the last half hour. Oh, it's just so sad. I just want to cry. They worship the crucified one supposedly all their life, but they never got it. They never got the naked, bleeding one for one moment. That this, as even Eckhart Tolle says, is a marvelous metaphor for the nature of the soul. But what does the dualistic mind do? We turn it into a substitutionary atonement theory by which Jesus' blood is necessary to change the mind of God so God can love the world. And it's just the most preposterous belief system. We Franciscans never did believe that. But we were a subtext inside of the main Catholic tradition, It's an icon for the nature of the soul. And everything that happened to the Christ is what must happen to the soul. But once you project it out there, over there, and worship it over there, instead of live it in here, you largely miss the point. And what you've got is, and this will lead us, I guess, into the night, what you've got is religion instead of spirituality. Or you have your object of worship, your imperial totem, and certainly that's exactly what the Christ became. Go to some of the Byzantine cathedrals or even the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C., if you've ever been there. It's a marvelous piece of architecture. But in the great apse, look at the image of Christ. It's a giant. It's the same Christ as on the back of the Sistine Chapel, you know? You know, it has nothing to do with this. You understand? It's all power. Because he became our available God figure. It wasn't about powerlessness anymore. It was about power. That's why we needed to rediscover the 12 steps. Because they resituated it right where it belonged. How evil was overcome was not a journey into willpower whereby I controlled it. But much more, you recognize it. And you see that you don't overcome. Like you don't become charitable by saying to yourself, be charitable. I mean, there's a number of ways I could say, but for our purposes here, it's you recognize the moments when you were totally uncharitable and you weep over it. That doesn't feel like power at all, does it? No one wants to go there. You walk out of the room and say, I just did it again. I just treated that woman as if she was inferior to me. Well, where did that come from inside of me? What is the part of me that needs to do that? That needs to look right, look good, control other people, think of myself as superior? Until you catch yourself doing that and weep over it, I don't think it changes. But the way most of us have been trained is this whole spirituality of perfection, willpower, determination. It's what we call in men's work, it's in that book, Wild Man to Wise Man, the heroic ascent, the hero's journey, where I can think of myself as heroic. One reason, and this ties on to what I was trying to say last night, why men in particular need a deliberate dose of spirituality is because they are so trained in heroic ascent that there's just nothing in them that thinks you will come to truth in any other way. I mean, we've seen it now for 4 years on the evening news. These sweet young 22-year-old boys over in Iraq, you know, I got to save my country. You know, I'm doing this, and you just want to kiss them. They're so sweet. You know, they mean well, and they've bought the lie, and they believe it. It's all, I'm going to do this by pushing. No spiritual tradition has ever said that except at its immature levels. And so it's not their fault, but then when you see them being bought back in caskets for believing that their heroic thing was the way, the spiritual teachers have always said it isn't the way. It does not lead to transformation. It does not lead to enlightenment on either side. Those who are doing the killing and those who are being killed both remain in their heroic illusions, which I'm going to call, for our purpose here, a spirituality of perfection or power or achievement. So striving, determination, which looks heroic, especially to the young male, and he prides himself on it, is almost the different movement. Picture striving and picture accepting God's love. Those are two different directions. Receptivity, which is why I know some feminists don't like this, but it was said by more than one poet and mystic, that the soul is always perceived as feminine before God. Because it's, and I'm not saying the feminine is always in the receptive mode, but, and I can see why feminists don't like it because of that, but because that's the way it was normally imaged in history, the soul was put in that position, that the soul is in this mode of receptivity, vulnerability, if you will, powerlessness. This is counterintuitive stuff. Because now the modern feminist doesn't even want to hear it. It isn't her agenda at all. And certainly she can't hear it from me as a male. If she's going to hear it at all, she's got to hear it from another woman. Because the woman who rightly feels inside of patriarchal culture, she was always one down and held the inferior position. She doesn't want to hear any talk of powerlessness, particularly from a man. And in that sense, women are at a real disadvantage in many circles today. There's no understanding of humility, of surrender, because now it's my time to be on top. And I've actually met certain groups where I can teach men better than the women, because the men know they've been on top too long and that it's led them to nothing, and it's illusion, and it's pretense, and it's a lie, and it's patriarchy, and it's sin, if you will. So they know, like Zacchaeus in the tree, they got to come down. But sometimes the woman who has never been up there feels she still has her right to her time on the stage, and she probably does. But don't stay there too long, or you'll miss the mystery, because there's nothing up there. As I love to quote Thomas Merton in that regard, you know, he said, you spend your whole life climbing the ladder, you get to the top of the ladder, and you realize it's leaning against the wrong wall. That's the recognition of all the saints. So what the Francis of Assisi and the Thérèse of Lisieux do is they just refuse to climb up the ladder. Now, admittedly, there's few people who are that enlightened that early who can do it. I think in both cases, Francis from his mother, Thérèse, it seems from her father especially, got this immense experience of unconditional love. So they got their narcissistic fix earlier, and that became their tower. You understand? That becomes your power. So you don't need to prove yourself by climbing and achieving and performing. So that might seem like a long preface to really what my primary remarks hope to be about, which is the spirituality of the 12 steps. So as I mentioned last night, I think it will go down as the American contribution to the history of spirituality. I think on point after point, it shows every aspect, which I'm not going to begin to be able to touch here, of real inspiration, real guidance from the Holy One. What they have named, and now we take for granted, as the language of addiction, I am increasingly convinced, is what the New Testament was calling possession. We modern and postmodern Western thinkers are rather embarrassed by any number of accounts of Jesus exorcising demons. And, you know, it's like, oh God, we don't believe in those, do we? It couldn't happen that easily, could it? And all the rest, and we sort of read the gospel, say thanks be to God, and turn the page to something that's a little more to our liking. But once you understand the nature of the addict, that they cannot not do what they want to do, that they're unfree people, it's like they are, if I dare use the language, possessed by an alien force. We didn't have much sympathy for that. Jesus did, which is why he's always going out to those who are supposedly possessed. But it really was Bill Wilson and the 12-step program that started the empathic, sympathetic, healing understanding of the addict. And the insight was correct. It doesn't happen by willpower. It doesn't happen by just saying, grit your teeth, then you can do it. It moves into the subtext, the counterintuitive text, the minority position of religion as receptivity instead of self-assertion and self-achievement. The religion, if you will, of the tax collector instead of the Pharisee. What spiritual writers are teaching us, Gerald May did this marvelously in his book, Addiction and Grace. He was a personal friend of mine. And I feel he was a true holy man, for me a real father figure. And he taught us that what we recognize is that any addictive behavior, this was his phrase, uses up desire. It especially drains away spiritual desire. And he was convinced, and I am too, especially from my years in the jail, that many addicts, in fact, in their younger years, were people with spiritual insight and people who had spiritual desire. People even who had early God experience. I'm not saying it was always true, but I'm amazed how much of the time it is true. And then when that got frustrated, when this world of communion and connection and compassion didn't happen, when all they met were the moralisms and ritualisms of religion, there's this great disappointment in many of them. I think they try to artificially maintain that world of communion by substance abuse. Although, as you well know, most addictions are not substance abuse. Most addictions are what we call process addictions. And I'm convinced, the more I try to teach meditation and contemplation, that without doubt, what the higher religious traditions are saying is the primary addiction that almost all of us suffer from is the addiction to our way of thinking. Stinking thinking, compulsive thinking. Contemplation 101 is teaching you how to observe your mind. And frankly, to see how ridiculous it is. One of the best things I think Eckhart Tolle said in his Power of Now was, you know, he said 83% of human thought was repetitive and useless. And I wrote him a letter. And I said, Eckhart, I only disagree with you on one point. I think it's 93%. And in one of his latest articles, he now has upped it to 98%. You just watch your stinking thinking. It's ridiculous. You say, how could you ever put trust in this vehicle to get you very far? You know, when you see how self-serving, how petty, how paranoid, how narcissistic and how needy it is. It's just, oh, come on. Well, always defending yourself, always asserting how you're right and they're wrong and all this silliness. Don't go there. But until you suffer that necessary humiliation, which we'll talk about when we talk about the Enneagram, you'll keep trusting that your mind can get you there. So I want to say that as a little sidebar in this lecture, that I do think the primary addiction is the mind. But this whole insight into the nature of addiction came from the first facing largely of the alcoholic addiction, later the drug addiction, and recognizing how unfree most people are, how possessed they are by foreign spirits, and that this is not a matter of culpability. Nothing you shame the person for. Jesus never shamed a single person that he exercised. He touched them. And all I can communicate in that is a transference of life, love, acceptance, energy to the other person. So what initiation, of course, is trying to say is that you cannot handle power at all until, at least the young boy in this case, was sent on some journeys of powerlessness. And isn't that obvious? We just can't keep electing heads of state who've never been on any journeys of powerlessness. You've got to know from the tradition that you can assume they are spiritually stupid, right? You've got to assume that. If all they've been their whole life is rich boys, Republican or Democrat, doesn't make a big bit of difference, right? Seeking their own career advancement and to make more money, how could they possibly understand the subtext? There's no way, unless somewhere they've been wounded. But if they make even their wounding into a born-again experience instead of a transformational experience that I take to myself as another merit badge of superiority, you see, you avoid the journey again. Even this has made me a born-again Christian. Now I am back in the Pharisee position, and I don't have to beat my breast humbly in the back of the temple, "Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner. I don't understand the bigger world. I don't understand any world except my own world of Texas." Now, if you can't see that in yourself, I guess I gave away who I was talking about. But it's not just him. I mean, it's all over the place. Yeah? But if the male has not gone onto those journeys, it's not even his fault. He isn't a bad guy either. He just doesn't know. It's Jesus' words from the cross. "Father, forgive them. They do not know what they're doing." And I know we wanted to put this whole day in the context of the mystery of forgiveness. Do you know that 2/3 of the teaching of Jesus, directly or indirectly, is about forgiveness? In fact, at this point in my life, after trying to study and pray over the Gospels all my life, I would summarize Jesus' teaching under two headlines, forgiveness and inclusivity. You go through his teachings. So you can see why they killed him. Because forgiveness is accepting the other, the beyond, the group. And inclusivity opens up to that fully, even structurally, and says, "I'm not here to defend the boundaries of my group. I'm not here to say my group is number one." When his own disciples try to do that, you remember when they come back saying, "The Methodists are driving out devils just as good as the Catholics. Should we call down fire from heaven upon them?" And he says, "No, boys, you've missed the point. If they're not against us, they're for us. Anyone who's doing the good work, let them do the good work. It doesn't matter what shingle they have on the front." He resists any attempt to make his teaching into groupthink, and yet we created Christianity out of it, you know? Which then, ironically, even became oppositional to Judaism, which was the last of his intentions. He died a good Jew. But recognizing that dark side of Judaism, which is the dark side of every religion. Now, the journey into powerlessness is more than anything else surrendering to that dark side, to that powerlessness, to weeping over it, to forgiving it. If 2/3 of the teaching of Jesus is about forgiveness, it's because what forgiveness is really not about this or that. It becomes an entire attitude of forgiving reality for being what it is. Forgiving the tragic flaw. Forgiving an imperfect world. Got it? That's why we had to name the original sin right front and center, even though it was poorly named. To say that there is a fly in the ointment of reality, and it's in your struggle with that wound, that fly in the ointment, that dilemma, that contradiction, that paradox that you are and that everything else is, that you move from unconsciousness to consciousness in the struggle itself. I'm sure that's why the Jews had to go around for 40 years in the desert. You know, there's a wonderful passage I quoted in my new book. You probably know, I think it's in Exodus, where it says, they were not taken by the direct route, but he took them the long route through the wilderness. Is that Exodus? Yeah. Marvelous passage. No one ever pointed that out to us Christians. You'd think they'd just take the straight line, you know. But it seems that Moses led them in circles. Maybe that's what you feel Richard is doing for you here, you know. Taking you by the indirect route through the wilderness. God, what a marvelous metaphor. That's what I say. The capsulized comment is always right there at the beginning. Huh? And that's in the struggle itself with the paradox, with the mystery, with the confusion, the complaining and the murmuring they go through, the creating of community, undoubtedly, because you can't see your own face, as you put it. So in the community, you start seeing your own pettiness, your own egocentricity, your own need to be right, your own need to be thought of as number one. And so very often, in fact, in my early years as pastor at New Jerusalem, the community in Cincinnati, I often felt that on an unconscious level, people came to join the community to face their own shadow. That the community became the container, and I'd see these just perky, you know, early 30-something young Catholics who'd done everything right and had a wonderful Catholic marriage and 2.5 perfect Catholic children. And, and they'd come to join New Jerusalem, and I'd say, in 3 months, their marriage is going to start having problems. You know? And it invariably would. It would fall apart because all the perfection was covering up a whole bunch of stuff they didn't want to deal with. So they got in a strong community, which they felt, okay, it'll hold us together so we can fall apart. I think we often do that. We often do that. We get into a container that's strong enough to hold us because we don't know how to hold ourselves at certain times and at certain periods. It might even be why some of you have come to this program. And I want to say that's okay. In fact, it might be very good. That this might be interiorly or exteriorly a time of major transition. And when the container gets strong enough, you might finally have the courage to face your shadow self, to stop pretending, to move to the back of the temple, to lower your head and beat your breast, and recognize that you are complicit in most of the evil that you hate. One reason I founded the center was because I recognized this year's our 20th anniversary. 20 years ago, I recognized that so many social activists, progressives, were precisely victims of that illusion. That they had also, just as people on the right do, people on the left can do the same, project all of their evil elsewhere and refuse to really go on the spiritual journey and to recognize their complicity in it all. Perhaps you saw the evening news last night where, you know, Al Gore, after winning the Oscar, you know, and the right is all upset that he won the Oscar for Inconvenient Truth. And so immediately what we had to see on the news last night was that Al Gore's electricity bill for 1 year in his house is $30,000 a year. So he's really not green himself, right? We just got to point out the dark side, the wound, the inconsistency that Al Gore is. Just like, I mean, I'm not surprised by that anymore. That doesn't mean that what he's saying is not true, but the dualistic mind will use that. Ah, Al Gore's electricity bill is $30,000 a year. Now I don't have to pay any attention to an inconvenient truth, do you see? So we'll all do that, right, left, and I suppose in between, because no one, unless they're taught or guided, will go to the place of powerlessness. Now, what addiction does, it doesn't teach you, it doesn't guide you, it forces you. Sometimes only after years, but eventually you wake up having ruined your marriage or your children or your job or your reputation, whatever it might be, and you have to say, this isn't working. There's got to be a better way to live my life. Now one of the other many good things that Bill Wilson said in his big book is, and this is not often taught because it feels like it's moving toward religion, this is a quote from Bill Wilson. He speaks of the necessity, quote, of a vital spiritual experience. Or without a vital spiritual experience, you will not find your way out of this. In other words, the only cure for possession is repossession. You have to be possessed by something better. And I'm convinced as a Christian, of course, that's what Jesus was doing. He walks in a very whole, wholesome, happy, and accepting, forgiving man in the presence of great people. Your littleness feels so little. Your addiction feels so unstable and immature, and you don't need it anymore. Unless there's a vital spiritual experience, normally you can't let go of what many characterize as the nature of the addictive mind. It's all or nothing thinking. It's invariably either or thinking. It's absolutist thinking. If it's not perfect, it's terrible. Now, can you see where a vital spiritual experience breaks that down? Because once you know that God has loved you in even your unlovability, which is always the character of a vital spiritual experience, you can't be dualistic anymore. Because all quid pro quo thinking falls apart. You're inside of mystery. You're inside of something that holds the imperfection. So now, what does perfection become? Perfection becomes not the exclusion of the contaminating element, the enemy, to use Jesus' language. But in fact, what perfection is precisely the ability to include imperfection. That's perfection. Got it? Oh, it takes us such a long time to get there. That's perfection. Why, it's all about forgiveness at the end. Forgiving reality for being what it is. Forgiving your children for not being the perfect kids you wanted them to be. Your husband, your marriage, your country, your church. It becomes a universal way of seeing. It is what it is. But apart from a vital spiritual experience, it's very hard to have the kind of container, the kind of containment to hold together the opposition. But God has to first do it in you. When God holds together your imperfection, you will find immediately the ability to do the same. In fact, by a backward form of argument, I always know that people who can do it, it has been done to them. It has been. They have been received. They have been forgiven. They have been embraced at the level of their imperfection, not their perfection. And when we talk about the anagram in the next session, we're going to see that we've all created a little pose, a little posture that we think will make us attractive and lovable. And that's why that's got to go. It's just got to go. Because as long as you keep living up to that, as long as those threes just keep performing, they'll think that the only reason you love them or reality loves them is because they're performing. Do you see? So God has to destroy their performance principle. And that's normally when the spiritual journey begins. So I want to repeat what I just said in passing there, that this note of all or nothing thinking, it's the nature of the dualistic mind, it's the nature of all religion before transformation, before conversion. We even speak, I'm sure you've heard the term, of dry drunks. How, you know, he hasn't had a drink for 15 years, but his mind is still all or nothing. Do you know people like this? And there's still problematic people sometimes in community, very difficult, because even though they've stopped the substance addiction, because there hasn't been any 11th step work, which I'm told is the least step done to develop a practice of prayer and meditation. And here again, we're seeing a wonderful convergence today, that our new understanding of contemplation leading you to non-dualistic thinking is precisely where Bill Wilson was again right. And recognizing that without 11th step work, really, you haven't transformed the addict. I'm sure you've all heard in the history of spirituality, the three classic, at least Catholic, stages, the purgative way, the illuminative way, the unitive way. It's still very good language, I would say. At most, what recovery is the purgative way. Unless you have some 11th step work, which leads you into inner illumination, and then the falling into the hands of the living God, and understanding unity, where any dualistic thinking simply falls apart and doesn't make sense anymore. Then it is done to you. It is not something you do by willpower, achievement, discipline, or performance. That's why Paula and I did so much work, and Ron Rollheiser and I too, on the two halves of life. That the first half of life is creating the container. But in a certain way, in the second half of life, believe it or not, I know this sounds iconoclastic and rebellious, but the container gets in the way. in the second half of life. If you spend all your life trying to prove that your religion is the best, or you're the only people going to heaven, or your rituals are the ones that do it, you know, that's the container, that's not the contents. Once you've fallen into the hands of the living God, you begin to experience the contents, and now the fall is infinite. It just, the mystery gets deeper and deeper and more spacious and more spacious, where you know you're not in control and someone else is. That's the language of the mystics, which is almost entirely non-dual language. Take the one from Jesus. My God, His sun shines on the good and the bad. His rain falls on the just and the unjust. Classic non-dual vocabulary. You know, what do you do with that? I doubt if popes quote that line very often. You can't make a group out of it. Do you understand? You can't hold together Roman Catholicism with that kind of language. What, you mean the sun's shining in Iraq today? Or in Pakistan on Osama bin Laden? No, please, I can't handle that. Yeah, I'm afraid it is. I'm afraid it is. And objectively, Osama bin Laden is a creature of God. And objectively, Osama bin Laden has come forth from God just like you have. Do you see why they killed him? No one likes to hear that because it breaks down the container. And when you put all your life into my container is better than your container, and my country is better than your country, and my gender is better than your gender, and there's only two of them, then you just... You just create enemies everywhere. And you see problems everywhere that you've got to either protect yourself from, which creates paranoid people, look at our politics today, or highly aggressive adversarial people who are always on the attack against these supposed enemies. Yeah? And many of our bishops in our country today are at the very same level. You wonder, have they not prayed? Have they not encountered the Holy One themselves? Maybe it's because they haven't been powerless. Maybe it's because they haven't sinned. You know, sin is a great teacher. Now, of course, we all have sinned, as Romans makes very clear. One of the wonderful discoveries as you work with Jesus, although it must be terrible to people who are, in this definition, Pharisees, go through the four Gospels, and I'd like you to note that Jesus is never upset at sinners. When you think of all the energy we put in and into ferreting out sinners and punishing them and excluding them, Jesus is only upset at people who don't think they're sinners. You can check that out. It's obvious. Once I tell it to you, I mean, I know a lot of you know it already, but it's very clear in the text. He's only upset at people who do not think they're sinners. And he used, at least the word that's translated in the Greek, is the word really for actor. Now, we've made it into the word hypocrite, which has all this negative connotation. But he's just saying they're split people. They're acting because they don't know the true self. They've never fallen into it or received it or experienced it. So they've got to act. Religion does, in that sense, create hypocrites, split people, because they can't go on the low road of powerlessness. Religion has almost been a training ground for the high road of performance. Do you see? The high road of my perfectibility, my what Thomas Merton calls my private salvation project. So little Therese here, you know, she said, I know when I'm a little one that, she says, I almost draw God's love toward me. He has to love me because I can't do it. So I bring to God not my perfection, but I bring to God my imperfection. And then with this utter confidence, she says, I know God comes rushing toward me. You know, John of the Cross said the same thing. John of the Cross said approximately the identical thing that physics says. Physics says, nature abhors a vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum. Whenever there's a vacuum, nature somehow has to fill it up. John of the Cross said the identical thing about the soul. He says, all God needs are vacuums, spaces. And whenever you provide God with space, God will fill it. Now, do you see what a spirituality of perfection did? It trained you to fill up your space with commandments and rituals and good behavior, stars and so forth. And you're so filled it yourself. There's no vacuum there for God to fill. There has to be room for another inside of you. All you can keep doing is providing God with emptiness. That's why Meister Eckhart loves the word detachment. Gelassenheit in German. I had to impress Richard. He knows I don't know languages like he does. this ability to always let go. To detach. It's almost his favorite word. I want to say, we haven't been taught the art of detachment since the Enlightenment. I mean, it's just a missing word in the West. It doesn't fit into the capitalist worldview. You want to talk about counterintuitive. Everything has been about attachment. No wonder we have an addictive society. No wonder addiction is everywhere, because people have only been trained in attachment and not the counterpart of detachment. They've been trained in power and performance, but not imperfection, detachment, and letting go, or least of all, surrender. Surrender to most Western people sounds like losing, when it's actually accessing a deeper, broader sense of the self, which is already content and abundant. Now, once you move to that level of deeper contentment and deeper abundance, you simply can't be drawn easily into these scarcity models of I'm not enough, this is not enough. You're overwhelmed by enoughness. And once you're overwhelmed by enoughness, you're not easily attracted to drugs and alcohol, misuse of alcohol. I like a good glass of wine, like I hope many of you do. But even one glass, or maybe two, is enough. It really is enough. I'm content. I don't need to alter my mood to be happy. I was happy before I had the first glass, but this added a little edge that was nice too. And God, it seems, does not begrudge us that. As Teresa of Avila, the other Carmelite mystic, said, you know, when God serves me partridge, I'll enjoy partridge. When God serves me porridge, I can enjoy porridge. Either one. Now that would seem to be the freedom of the children of God. But that's what the addict does not know how to do. They need a concocted partridge every day. You know, I've got to make the best for myself, which is, of course, an artificial best, does not last, and that's why you always need more and more of what doesn't work, which becomes addiction. So just to sum it up, I do think the teaching on addiction and the understanding of addiction has given us a whole new understanding of the character of spiritual desire and how wounds are healed and how evil is overcome. How we enter into goodness and how we let go of badness. And I want to say as strongly as I can that it is not done by force. It is not done by pushing, demanding, by willpower, by any kind of heroics. Even though heroics immediately feed the ego and make you feel superior. When I spiritually direct people, I have to strongly counsel them to mistrust any heroic gestures. They're much more food for the ego than they are food for God. God doesn't need your heroics. God needs who you really are. Who you really are. And that's all you could ever give to God is not an idealized self, not a so-called perfect self. Perfection is a mathematical concept. And now the new math says that's not even true. The entire universe seems to be operating out of chaos theory of one sort or another. And whatever made us think that it was different than that. Well, the thing that did more than anything else was religion. Taught us we could be perfect. Darn it. Darn it. That has just split unbelievably unbelievable generations of people. Now, Paul gives us in Corinthians a marvelous one way out of that. Of course, the Hebrew tradition would just say, God alone is good. God alone is perfect, as Jesus quotes. But what Paul does with a kind of cleverness is he situates the wholeness in the whole body of Christ. The body of Christ for Paul is a force field. It's humanity. It's all who are willing to be connected or in it. It doesn't have anything to do with the Christian religion. It's this reality of universal connection in God. And he says, you know, some of us are hands and some of us are eyes and some of us are ears. And I always say, I'm a mouth. That's all I am. But I'm so aware that I'm not so many other parts at all, at all. And when you can accept that I'm just a mouth, I'm just an ear, but the wholeness is in the whole body. And then each member can defer to one another, as Paul says in another place, out of reverence for the Christ. Because the Christ is the whole mystery. I always have to tell Christians, Christ is not his last name. All right? It's a title. It's a title given that we gave to this Jesus because he held for us this great big mystery together. Of this force field of those who lived in love and those who lived in union. He held it together. And Jesus, the Christ, for Christians, would probably be the more correct way to say it. And whoever does that for you, I suppose, is your anointed one, is your Messiah, is your Christ, who holds together heaven and earth, the human and the divine, the spiritual and the material, my group and all groups. But we're already going to see that in Isaiah. Right? We're already going to see that in the prophets pushing out the walls of the tent to accept and to understand the larger mystery. So let me conclude by saying that's one of the things that I love so much about many people in recovery who've learned to breathe underwater is they tend to have this humility about the world, about human nature. About groups. Normally they'll even let you poke a little fun at 12-step groups. Because that can become your new container. Do you understand? Which will keep you in the purgative way forever. If you don't realize that's only part of the journey too. And some people, I mean, they're talking about their recovery groups gets tiresome. There's something more than being in recovery. There's something about illumination. There's something about union, which is the final journey. So we all do it. And I want to point out that little potential temptation, even in the 12-step work, to do what Judaism did with Judaism, what Catholicism did with Catholicism, what Protestantism did with Protestantism, and what Alcoholics Anonymous can do with Alcoholics Anonymous. Make it an end in itself. Make it a container that has to be perpetuated for itself instead of a pathway to a union and transformation, to the contents itself. So, not much more than an introduction, but I hope that will lead you, even those of you who might not consider yourself addicts, to recognize the universal character of addiction and the real genius, not just of the 12 steps, but even structurally, the 12 traditions. Which do not depend so much upon, you know, promotion, but attraction. If we had defined the church instead of promotion, attraction. Just be. Like Mother Teresa, that when I went to Calcutta, they said she never tried to make anybody into a Catholic. And her second level nuns told me this. She never tried to preach Jesus to anybody. She said, our job is not to talk about Jesus. Our job is to be Jesus. Right? That's what the 12 steps discovered. Goodness does not move by promotion, but by attraction. The real, the transformed, attracts by its very nature.
For more information on other books and recordings by Father Richard Rohr, call the Center for Action and Contemplation Resource Center at 505-247-1636 or visit the center's website at cacradicalgrace.org.